It's been 75 years since the attack on Pearl Harbor. The story of what happened that day has been well documented, even romanticized on the silver screen. And you may think you've heard all there is to know about the attack. But a new book by my next guest offers some fresh perspectives on the tragedy, the politics, and the heroism as well from that day. Craig Nelson is the author of the new book, Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness. He'll be in Atlanta next week to talk about the book, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to start with your Georgia connection, because as I understand all this, this is not in the book. Your mother was working in Atlanta during the war as an air traffic controller, right?
Yes, both my parents worked during World War II. My father was stationed with the Air Force in New Guinea, and my mother worked was a war worker working as an airplane controller in Atlanta, and now my best friend from high school lives there. So I'm very tied to the beaches.
So why another book on Pearl Harbor? As I mentioned, there have been so many books on it, so many movies, both good and bad. What do we still not know?
Well, the last really big definitive history of Pearl Harbor was researched 50 years ago. And between the fact that we didn't have much material on the Japanese then, that so many of the eyewitnesses were traumatized by what they had gone through, and that so many people had experiences of Pearl Harbor that hadn't come through, and we didn't have the historical perspective, I felt it was time for a new one. And I put together a team and spent 5 years researching and writing this book. And I came to the decision that Pearl Harbor is really what made America what we are today. Our leadership role on the global stage, that we have the biggest military in the world, the size of our intelligence agencies, the size of our overseas financial aid programs and foreign aid programs, the beginning of our nuclear arsenal, and the fact that we haven't had a World War III in 70 years all began at Pearl Harbor.
So this is the argument, more like the central premise of this book. And one of the things that you argue is about all of the warnings that the U.S. government had. There have long been conspiracy theories about Pearl Harbor, but what did you discover about what the government did and did not know before the attack happened?
Well, there are actually only two real significant warnings. One came in January 1941, almost a year before the attack, when the Peruvian ambassador in Japan warned the American ambassador in Japan that he had heard rumors that if the things deteriorate further between the United States and Tokyo, that Tokyo will attack Pearl Harbor. And our ambassador passed this on up, and it went to the military, and they said, we don't believe this at all. But the other serious warning came in August 1941 when a character named Dusan Popov showed up at the offices of the FBI. Now, Popov was this fantastic character. He was a triple agent. He worked simultaneously for the Yugoslav intelligence community. He worked for the British, and he worked for the Nazis. And the Nazis had sent him to America with a 3-page questionnaire to fill out, and a whole third of that questionnaire was about Pearl Harbor. And he took this to the FBI, and he explained why it was suspicious. But because he was working for all these different sides, and because he was having an illicit affair with Simone Simone, the star of Cat People, J. Edgar Hoover didn't take him seriously and refused to pass on the information.
He had three different code names for each different agency he was working for. You point out he was Disco to Yugoslavia, he was Tricycle to Britain, and the Germans knew him as Ivan.
Yes, exactly.
Very, very interesting character. So another thing that you talk a lot in the book about, which is something that other books have not focused on, is what was happening in Japan leading up to the attack. And while in the United States they saw Japan as this highly efficient, very organized, united nation, you present a very different picture in your book. What did you discover about the state of Japan and the state of war movements there?
Well, we have always been taught that the government in Japan was just like the Nazis. They were this unified fascist force constantly looking for world domination. And when we actually looked in the recent material on that history coming out of Japan, what we found was a nation that was really in total chaos. The army was fighting with the navy. The army was fighting with the civilian government. The army had dragged the country into this sort of crazy war in China that was sort of like Japan's Vietnam. It was this morass and quagmire that they didn't really want to be there anymore, but they couldn't really bring themselves to get out of. And there was this constant struggle. And of course, the country was poor in natural resources, and America did supply 80% of her petroleum. And she was looking for a way out of that. But even in all this territory they kept conquering across the 1930s, they could never find a solution for that. And you had this core nationalist fascist group who basically took over the government by assassinating civilian leaders. And after the war, when Hirohito was asked why he didn't do more to stop things, he said, well, if I had done more, I would have been assassinated or thrown into an asylum.
So, I mean, it must have been very difficult to find, track down some of the people that you found since it's been 75 years, but you were able to interview a number of survivors. And since we're talking about the Japanese effort, I wonder if you'd tell the story of, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Zenji Abe, who was an enemy dive bomber pilot.
Well, this is one of my favorite stories in the book. Zenji Abe was one of the lead pilots in the dive bomber group, and he felt like he had done a very good job during World War II. He went on to have a big military career, and after the war, he became a policeman. But then he discovered that Japan had not announced war before attacking Pearl Harbor, and he thought this was shameful. And he went on a campaign across the country to get his fellow airmen in the attack on Oahu to sign a letter of apology. And he took that letter and he flew to the United States and he tracked down one of the heads of the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association who happened to live in Atlanta. And he showed up in Atlanta and knocked on the door and explained in his poor English what he was doing. And the guy said, the American said, well, you can take that letter and shove it where the sun don't shine, and slam the door in his face. And Abe was, of course, really upset, but he didn't give up. He got a group of Japanese aviators to start regularly attending Pearl Harbor Survivor Association reunions on December 7th in Hawaii. And at one of them, they met a Marine bugler who had been aboard the West Virginia named Richard Fisk. And Richard Fisk had the horrible luck of surviving not only Pearl Harbor, but also Iwo Jima, which Fisk said was 32 days straight of Pearl Harbor. And during this, from this trauma that he had gone through, Fisk had developed a visceral hatred of Japanese people. He just couldn't stand them. But when he saw these three old men like himself, old soldiers, decades later, he just reached out and started hugging them. And Abe and Fisk developed a friendship where Abe financed Fisk to go to the memorial every month and lay a white and a red rose and play taps in Japanese and in English. And eventually Fisk was given an Order of the Rising Sun by Emperor Akihito for promoting friendship between Japan and America. And when a Japanese man came and saw him at his very last reunion and touched his arm and burst into tears, Fisk said, "Don't cry. After all, my daughter married a Japanese boy, so what can you do?"
We're speaking with Craig Nelson. His new book is called Pearl Harbor, From Greatness to Infamy. I want to return to what's basically your argument in this book, and that you spent all these years researching in order to prove, I guess, which is that Pearl Harbor changed our entire country, possibly forever. Why do you think Pearl Harbor has played such a huge role in the fact that there has been no World War III?
I think that Pearl Harbor and World War II were so devastating and so shocking and so traumatic that they turned American leaders into winners 1945 like no one else has ever won a world war. And one of the most amazing transformations is in Douglas MacArthur, who starts out in this book as kind of a stinker. And then when he shows up at the surrender, he says the most incredibly magnanimous, generous things about how it's time to stop the thinking of who's the enemy, who's the foe, and go on together in a world of peace. And in 1945, America did essentially reverse reparations. You know, when you win a big world war, you're supposed to get money and territory. You're not supposed to use your money to rebuild your enemies, but that's what we did. We used our money to rebuild Japan and Germany and a lot of Europe and a lot of Asia. And because of that program, George Marshall, the head of the army, who was then Secretary of State and started the Marshall Plan to rebuild. He was the first professional soldier to win the Nobel Peace Prize. Mm. And in the same story, Cordell Hull, who was sort of a bumbling Secretary of State, in the end of it, he wins the Nobel Peace Prize for beginning the United Nations. Yeah. So it's an incredible ending to this story.
Craig Nelson is author of Pearl Harbor, From Great to Infamy. He'll tell other incredible stories at the Atlanta History Center on Monday, October 10th. Craig, thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste.